Thank you very much. I think we're fortunate to have diverse views on the panel, and I hope that that questions will be both sensitive and straight to the point. Can we get people lining up on both sides at the microphones? And if you'd like to address your question to a specific panelist, please identify them. So let's start. Please identify your name and what school you go to or your affiliation, and we'll start on the right side, my right.
Hello, my name's Clarinda De Cruz, and I'm about to start at Oxford University, and I want to thank AID, and I want to thank the panelists, and my question is for Mr. Idris, I'm not sure how you say your name. I was wondering if you could expand on the possibilities to which you made reference during your remarks. Thank you.
Do you want to take questions, or how do you want to do it? You want
me
to...
Let's take three, and then we will take the answers. I think it'll move quicker that way. So let's take one, your question, and then we'll go back to this side.
Okay. My name is Atik Mirza, and I don't know if I have a question as much as I have a suggestion. I really came here today to hear the panel, but I want some constructive and concrete resolutions of the issues. I think there are issues that relate to America, how it relates to the Muslim world, but there's also the issue of how America relates to its own Muslim population. And if that could be addressed, I think importance would be to identify the issues, because unless we identify the issues, we will not have any recommendations and solutions. And then, of course, followed by the recommendations to how those issues can be resolved. I can only speak for myself as a Muslim American. I face a very hostile America today. I have lived in this country for 30 years. I have never broken any laws of this land. And yet when I go out today, I have to defend myself for things that other people did, crimes committed by other people. How do we resolve that? I mean, how does America come to terms with there's maybe 5 or 10 million Muslims in this country, a great country of ours, and yet maybe a handful of people who were born or were American citizens have committed crimes, and yet we paint with a very wide brush and hold a whole community responsible for the crimes of just 0.0001% or whatever. How can we justify that? So
okay,
if you would address that. Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to this.
I'll open this up to any panelists, but in specific to Ms. Mehra. And I appreciate your optimism, but if we take a step back and we look at the reality of the situation, no matter how many Muslims we send here to America or how many Americans we send abroad, the reality is that the vast majority of Muslims will never engage with Americans, and except in two ways, and either through Western media or through American foreign policy. If you actually put aside Western media, because I know the second panel will be addressing media, but if you actually look at American foreign policy, what exactly is the State Department doing to address this issue? And in particular, I find that the normalization of relations with Gaddafi's Libya to be in contradiction of this democracy rhetoric. And so I'm hoping that you can address that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So we'll address those three questions. First, Mr. Idris.
That was very nice. You just set me up to finish my talk. Thank you. There'll be money in it for you later. I think, I think on the double standards issue that I mentioned, politically it's very difficult who's going to speak out and who's not. Now, we have a representative from Human Rights Watch here. That is her job, and she does it very effectively. And, you know, although I'm a representative in some ways of the UN, I guess, I'm quite new to the system, I have serious questions about the role that multilateral organizations can play on two fronts. On the one hand, you're trying to develop among all your constituent members, whether you're the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the United Nations, the Arab League, the Organization of American States, whatever multilateral body you're part of, you're trying to develop some sense of common values and systems by which we will all live and agree to them, right? And there's some excellent developments on that front, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, these kinds of things. At the same time, you are the body that is going to help mediate between your constituent members when there are differences. And I have serious doubts about whether our ability at this point in the game, how we organize ourselves politically across the globe, how able are we going to be to really live by those universally agreed by standards. If they're going to be at the remit of multilateral organizations to enforce and ensure compliance with, I think they're always going to fall prey to whichever political powers happen to be strongest at that moment. Because the temptation of sort of narrow-minded or short-sighted political leaders, if they can get away with it and they think it's in their interests, they're going to get away with it. And so I think it's really at the civil society level, while we push the political leader to do a better job of living by these standards that we all have agreed to globally, it's the job of civil society leaders, Human Rights Watch and others, and you all, to keep political leaders' feet to the fire in the Muslim world, in the West, everywhere, to really be advocates and to push for these kinds of things and to call out, especially when those double standards are used. Now, I think a couple quick things. The line between religion and politics is so blurred today in so many places, and a lot of political conflicts are getting articulated in religious terms. And once you do that, politics gets wrapped up in people's religious identity, and it becomes very difficult to resolve them. Political leaders need greater training and need greater advising from people who understand both political and religious minefields when they're dealing with foreign policy issues. They need that at the UN. They need that in individual states. Norway, the Foreign Ministry of Norway just now is developing this. They're going to have an advisory board of religious and political experts who advise them on their foreign policy, particularly when they're dealing with cultures whose religions they don't know nearly as well. At the people-to-people level, the connections are very important, and you're right, only a few people can participate in them directly. But the media is a very relevant space, and not just the internet, and not just the news media. The news media is always focused on, and it's important, but popular dramatic programming, co-productions between production companies based in the Muslim world and those based here in the West, print publications, you know, internet chat that's facilitated, not just the kind of barbs back and forth. And I think non-Muslims can actually help and have a role, even if you don't think you should, in facilitating intra-Muslim dialogue and debate. There's a lot of that's quite important for a number of reasons. The Muslim community, and this goes to the gentleman's point, is not enfranchised as a community, you know, particularly in the West. When you're enfranchised and somebody of your identity group does something wrong, you're not all blamed for it, either by your population or by your government looking to rooted out. The Muslim community is not enfranchised. This is going to take a lot more work. We live in a country here in the States where that's open to us, even in the now more chilling atmosphere, and we just need to organize ourselves and especially support young people. And the last piece that I would mention is facilitating cooperation on social justice issues. Those resonate with a lot of people of faith, and a lot of people who are more secular. I think that kind of cooperation is very important. And in this country, I would focus especially on the Muslim-Jewish nexus. You know, there is, I agree with much of what was said from the representative from Human Rights Watch. At the same time, I can't, you know, I don't speak that way. I can't speak that way. Part of why I don't is because I also think we need to all be heard by the people we're most trying to convince. And I think it's important for human rights organizations to speak power to truth, truth to power, rather. But I think for those of us who aren't going to go in that field, you got to find ways to link with the people who most disagree with you. And on the Muslim-Jewish nexus in this country, that's where I think the biggest problem lies. And when it comes to Israel-Palestine or it comes to any of these issues, if you hear something you like and you applaud for it, that's great. At the end of the day, we're not going to get anywhere if someone's booing at the top of their lungs while you're applauding at the top of yours, vice versa. We've got to find a way to build those kinds of bridges, and that just takes a lot of trust building.
Thank you. Yes.
So let me thank people for their insightful questions. I know that you want me not to talk about media and just talk about foreign policy, but the reality is that things do go hand in hand. And the question was, what is the State Department doing to sort of help improve the image of the West or improve relations between the West? And, I mean, let me just give you an example where we have our embassy in Baghdad, right? And there is a team of people out there at our embassy, a team of Americans, that works directly with the press corps. And they actually helicopter the press corps around to different sites in Iraq to show them what the Americans and what the coalition is doing. And they show them schools. They show them hospitals. They showed them a mass grave site where Americans were helping to exhume bodies and to sort of do a truth and reconciliation. And the story that came out of that was on the front page of a newspaper, and the story was about mass graves. And then the story basically alleged that Bush 1 had helped contribute to the mass graves because they had spurred on this Kurdish uprising. And so, I mean, whatever, what's true, what's not, it's interesting. It's like, we have to work with the media. Like, we have a great story to tell. In so many cases, we have a fantastic story to tell. And the question is, what do you want to hear? Really, what do you want to hear? Do you want to hear somebody saying, we give a third of our foreign aid budget to Israel, a third of our foreign aid budget to Egypt? But what you didn't hear was that that's part of the Camp David Accords. And if I'm not mistaken, that was part of Israel pulling settlements out of the Sinai. So it's not like we can really go back on that. I mean, that's a multilateral treaty agreement that we have. You know, and you don't hear that. But if you hear that we don't care about the Palestinians and the plight, I mean, I'm shocked. We just had a huge meeting because of the humanitarian disaster that's going on in Palestine right now and because of the Hamas government, and to ensure that humanitarian relief kept getting to the Palestinians. Through all of the work, we contribute 20%. Everyone knows 20% of the UN's budget comes from the U.S. And it's through the UN programs like UNRWA, through the UN refugees program that we help support Palestinian refugees. So if you want to hear, we don't care about Palestinians, and that's what you're going to hear, but it's not the truth. We go hand in hand with the media, and we really do have a wonderful story to tell. We give so much. We are such a generous country. We should always be proud to be Americans. We are such a generous country with what we do and what we give to Muslim countries. But if people aren't willing to hear it, I mean, that's where you all come in, right? That's where you all come in. You have to help people listen, and we can't have this, you know, this sort of useless debate where there's untruth, there's half-truths that are being passed around. I'm taking an opportunity to respond to the other speaker, because I just think, you know, when somebody says close Guantanamo and everybody applauds, well, you know, the president has said, he's like, I would like to close Guantanamo. I would love to close Guantanamo. I mean, but the reality is that there are very dangerous terrorists in Guantanamo. And we actually released some of we released terrorists back. They went into the theater of battle and they killed Americans again. So the president would love to close Guantanamo, but it's not a feasible option right now, and it's something that we're working towards as an ambition. So thanks for letting me respond to the other speaker in addition to responding to the question. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I see that there are a lot of questions, and we don't have as much time, so I'm going to ask speakers to try to limit their responses to under a minute, if possible. I know that's extremely difficult. Can I take three more questions? You first.
Hi, this is for Mera? Oh, hi, how are you? I'm Alexandra Dolce. I'm counsel for the New York City Comptroller's Office, and I'm also a grad student. And this is more of a request than a question. When you were speaking, you were very enthusiastic about saying that, you know, this is America and we should all go work for the State Department, work for government, yada, 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 yada. And I understand that, and I understand that the State Department has very high standards. My request to you is that, first of all the postings that I've seen for the State Department, they're very particular about whom they want. And I get angry because it's my tax dollars. You can't tell me, well, we only want certain graduates. And I'm paying, my tax dollars are going to hire someone else. It doesn't make sense. So my request to you is to go back and maybe change that PR campaign and really, really try, really, really, really try to go into America and recruit people from diverse backgrounds who can really, really go abroad and give something our perspective. Not only people from Georgetown, not only people from American, yada, yada, yada. Thank you.
Okay. Let's take the question from the woman in the white shirt.
Hi, yes. Mine's also to Ms. Mehra. So, I'm sorry. This is regarding the Middle East sort of partnerships for the democracy. I just came back from a conference regarding for Fulbright, and we've all been briefed on this as well. But I'm coming from Latin America and being aware of the democratic interventions that, specifically in Central America that the United States did, especially now that it's 20 years later in some of those cases. And you see that Latin American politics is now in your newspapers with the left populist people coming up. But anyway, is the United States department understanding that bringing democracy in the Middle East is not really about elections and candidates, that are U.S. friendly, and I'm referring that to the Palestinian elections with Hamas, but it's through education and literacy that creates a civil society that can organically bring about their own version of democracy, not what we, the United States government, really wants, but what they want.
Thank you for that question, and we'll take one more.
Okay, hi, this question, it's not really a question, it's just a response to what Ms. In had stated, my name is Rubina Madni, I'm a student at Yale Law School. You had said that you believe that the Muslim world and the West are on the right track, and yet you also said that a lot of your Muslim colleagues believe that Islam is oppressing them. I would just like to respond to that and say that I vehemently disagree. I'm empowered by my faith. I'm not an object. I'm an intellect. And not only am I an intellect, but my religion, 1,400 years before 1920, gave me the right to vote. 1,400 years before the second wave of the feminist movement gave me the right to keep my last name after marriage. It gave me the right to choose my husband. It gave me the right to keep my property, inheritance. It gave me the right to get a job and keep the money that I earn. So if you believe that we're on the right track, I also believe it's important to not actively perpetuate these myths about Islam that are given out by uninformed individuals. Islam is a feministic religion, and it empowers women more than people wish to believe or are informed about. And that's very important to people.
Thank you for that comment. So, first, Ms. Mira, for a short response.
Thank you. So for 1 minute. So to the woman who was talking about recruiting for this, the State Department, first of all, it's not that you just have to come work for government. Like, we contract with so many nonprofit and grassroots organizations, so that's also an option, right? I hear you totally. I think we at the State Department totally agree we need to encourage diversity, and we're very supportive of it. Foreign Service exam is open to everybody. So if you are interested in Korean government and with state specifically, the Foreign Service exam is open to everybody. So anyway, we totally agree. I mean, diversity is something that we absolutely need to work on, and very supportive of that comment. Regarding MEPI and democratic, I think the question was, does the State Department understand that democracy and bringing democracy to regimes is not about only pushing a party that we like, and do we know that it's about literacy, and do we know that it's about... Absolutely. I mean, really, the education literacy are some of the most... I work on women's empowerment. Those are education literacy are some of the most empowering things that we can do for women and for people across the world. In fact, the First Lady is hosting at this year's General Assembly a global literacy event where she hopes to endorse U.S. literacy programs. So absolutely. If you are interested in, you know, what... I mean, really, do people think that when we talk about democracy that we're talking about regime change? That's not the case. We're not talking about that. If, you know, if you're interested, check out USAID's website and talk in the democracy and governance programs that we do. They're fabulous. It's about teaching women how to, for example, form political parties. It's about political party support. It's about independence of the judiciary. It's about police training. There are so many elements that go into encouraging and supporting democracy, and it's not just about regime change or just about supporting one party over the other, and that's something that we do fundamentally understand. Thank you.
Okay, people are clapping for her. So I'm going to address, I'm agreeing with you. That was my point, as a matter of fact, that if you, and thus speaking the same language, correct? I think in both, really, faith-wise, and I've studied both faiths, and as a matter of fact, I think I kind of sit in the middle because I was, well, it really doesn't mean, but when I was born, everyone around me was Buddhist. So I'm neither Muslim or Judeo-Christian. But at the same time, I think that's exactly what I'm alluding to, that faith-wise, it's to have respect for all humanity. But when we look at the superficial level and what people have felt, and it's the same for both religion and for all religion, that people who are in power, and thus giving the Catholic example, that it has shown that people who had the authority oppressed women. And that's the way it may seem as well. But to me, going back to what the other question said, is to truly addressing the fundamental problems like education, having education for all women, all girls, is to address like things like poverty, finance, economics, things that are more basic than you know, arguing about your religion, my religion. That's actually what I was getting at.
Thank you. Okay, let's take three more questions, starting with you.
My name's Tahira Muhammad. I'm a journalist and a freelance writer and an advocate for immigration rights and improving relationships between Africans and African Americans. My question is more like a statement combined question. On the 4th of July, this country celebrated its 21st or 251st or 252nd birthday. I'm sorry, I can't remember which, a few days ago. But as a concerned American Muslim, I study the history of my country, and I feel like our maturity level when it comes to the fear factor of differences in different groups, such as in the 18th century, the white settlers against the Native Americans, the Puritans, the Jews, and the Holocaust, the fear of spread of communism, like that was demonstrated in the recent documentary, Good Night and Good Luck. And now it's the fear of America against Muslims and Islam. And my question to any panelist is, how can we grow past the mentality of the fear factor in the essence of not just improving relations between Muslims and the West, but other future groups that may appear to be different in the future, that are beyond just the quote-unquote normal American society? Because if it's Muslims today, if we don't correct our behavior, it'll be someone else tomorrow.
Thank you, and let me take your question.
Hello. I first would like to say that I'm really excited that this is the first time I've really seen a panel where there are so many people really actively engaged in women's rights, which I think is really cool. But I've also learned kind of over the past couple of years how tied gender inequality is to issues of sexuality. And I'm kind of at a loss because I hear people talking more and more about women's rights. But when I read in the news about how there are prides happening on an international scope that people are getting death threats for, or I also kind of recently read that someone, a gay teen, was put to death just for because he was found out. I think he was closeted at the time. But I'm just kind of asking this about awareness because I want to know if there's anything going on at an international level to address these kinds of concerns and how I would be able to get involved. Because if I look here in this country, I know what needs to be done. I know there's a lot that needs to be done. I know how to get involved. But on an international level, nobody's really talking about it. So thanks.
Thank you. And we'll take one more question from the left side.
Hi, this question is for Ms. Whitson.
Your left.
You mentioned that much of the U.S. support, much of the U.S. support of Israel comes from lobbyists in Washington. Well, what do you propose we do to create a balance in Washington lobbying so that the U.S.'s agenda doesn't seem that it's primarily in Israel's favor?
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have a comment on the first comment that was made?
Yes. I think that just a brief comment is about our own responsibility and strategies. I think that every time we recognize that victimhood is not right, and we revisit the past to learn, I think we are actually contributing to an understanding that goes back to the idea of common humanity and the possibility of a common future. And I think that this country in particular has a lot to revisit. A lot to revisit. It's a country that has an incredibly violent history. And I think that unless that history is revisited, somehow, hopefully, I can see from your flyer that you have something to do with hope. It's a good one. So I think that we can work on it. Thank you.
Thank you. And would either of you like to speak about the global efforts for empowering women?
I think you meant GBLT issues. The speaker.
Okay. Would anyone like to speak on that?
I guess if I understood the question correctly, which is sort of global issues with respect to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, it is actually new to the human rights scene as a human rights issue. The Human Rights Watch does have a GBLT division, and we have done some work in the Muslim world where it is a big, big problem for if you happen to be GBLT. And the Middle East North Africa division has taken up a number of cases of gay men being persecuted, gay men being jailed and tortured in Egypt, in Kuwait, in the Emirates, in Iran, executed actually for being gay men. And it's a very troubling issue. There is one gay men's organization called Helim in Lebanon, which actually had a public rally, now the second one, two in a row, which is pretty radical, but Lebanon's a pretty radical place. We asked them, what should we do? We in Human Rights Watch we're a global organization, our headquarters are in New York, what should we do? Because we're seen as a Western organization. And they said, you know, we need to build this internally, because if outside people come and make this the issue, then it'll be rejected as an outside issue, which, of course, many extremists try to pigeonhole it and dismiss it as such.
And then would you like it to also address the lobby?
Oh, the lobby. the non-existent lobby. Two trite answers could be, well, more lobbies, since they're so great, let's just have more of them, and let's have a Muslim lobby that's as strong as the Israel lobby, and so on and so forth. But I don't know how many lobbies we'd need to have to counterbalance the very sort of organized, disciplined, extremely effective Israel lobby. So, you know, you can try to have more lobbies to get more voices heard. But it's definitely a huge uphill battle. The other somewhat trite answer is campaign finance reform. That would solve the problem of many lobbies, not just the Israel lobby. But, you know, again, a huge uphill battle, as you all have seen. I think the key issue is not to be intimidated, not to be silenced, to keep speaking out on the issues, to keep letting journalists and academics, in this country in particular, write and speak about the issues, because there has been a chilling effect in the past decade. And it just needs to be resisted.
Thank you. And we'll just take one more round of three questions. I apologize that we can't address more. Excuse me?
We started over on this side.
We started that side.
Yes. And please just make your question as brief as possible so we can have time for answers.
I'll try. The main thing I want to talk about, which hasn't been mentioned yet, really, and I guess Dr. Stewart, the two speakers haven't really spoken much yet on the right side, which is the internal conflict within Islam, which is sort of a reformation which is going on right now, and which is really, I think, the heart of what we call the Western Islam conflict. It's really something between them, and we're not really involved in it. My main question, I guess, would be regarding our place in a democracy in the Middle East and what we define as democracy, what institutions we think are required for democracy, and whether we think necessarily that secularization is necessary to have democracy, whether you can have an Islamic government, and what type of, what aspects of Islam are can go into democracy and which ones are non-compatible. And then a quick comment to Ms. Whitson. I was surprised to hear your comment about the funding to Israel and Egypt. Egypt actually gets 2/3 of the funding that Israel gets because of the deal, and that was the withdrawal from the Sinai. So that's the piece there is because of that, the American funding. I was just surprised to hear you say that we should cut funding to Israel instead of saying we should increase funding to other areas. I think that Israel was necessary for the Jews, pogroms and the Holocaust, and tons of massacres across Europe. I think that it was time for a Jewish state, and I think that the answer is not to weaken them, but to possibly shrink the Palestinians and give a two-state solution. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment.
To Mr. Idris, you mentioned earlier that in terms of helping to smooth or to develop Western Muslim relations, that it's really important to focus on the Jewish and Muslim nexium. And while I think that's a very important point, I would also encourage, especially in terms of American-Muslim relations, that you also start having dialogues with other minority groups in this country. Because when you focus on that nexum and the idea of mainstream America, you're actually really talking about middle-class white people. And while that's a huge part in having that conversation, there's a different language and a different dialogue that needs to go on with people of color, because unfortunately there's a lot of antagonism, miscommunications, and things of that nature that are going on between Muslim and Arab Americans in this country, black people, Latino people, who've had different struggles and met with different situations, but currently are in the same issue of, I'm a person of color in a country that's not always thrilled that I'm here. So having that, encouraging those type of connections, I think are very important, because you're pulling more people who are going to be supportive, who are going to talk, share strategies, build a network that's going to support each other. We may not always agree, and we probably won't, but just the fact that we're engaging in that from a position that's a little bit different will help to build, I think, and build a more stronger voice, I guess.
Okay, thank you. One more question.
Assalamu alaikum, ismi Baraka. Good afternoon, my name is Rachel. My question is one of education, and this might seem
kind of like a fundamental aspect to education, but often it's kind of occluded. And I realized it when I was reading some information about Israel and the Arab Israelis in Palestine and the education system there. The entire history of the Arab population has been basically wiped out of Israeli textbooks. And also the Arab population are not allowed to learn their own history. So this propagates the conflict that's there because there's not an understanding of each other. And this is true also of a on a global scale. How can we, or are there attempts to, nationwide in both America and throughout the Muslim Arab world, to bring into the education systems an understanding of each other, to fully teach the youth about the different cultures?
Okay, thank you. Would anyone like to speak on the kind of internal reformation within the Muslim faith? The first question.
There was a piece of that question that also included the terms we're not really involved, and that's where the difficulty comes. Not just because we're living in an interdependent world, so we are very much involved with one another, but because the U.S. in particular has chosen its dog in that fight, if you want to put it that way. You know, I think in the Muslim world, particularly in the Middle East, there's such political oppression still, although there has been some transformation in the last decade in some countries. There's such political oppression, and what you have in response to that is, in my view anyway, are two kinds of resistance. One which is largely secular and elite and fairly disconnected from its societies, and one which is deeply religious and mixes religion and politics. The U.S., in terms of both who it would like to see in power, but also if you look at where the funding goes, which civil society groups get funded, if you want to support activism, civil society activism, I'd be interested in the profile of the organizations that one supports. Does one put any of the money into the religious political movements that maintain much of the social networks in many of these countries, or is it all going to the fairly secular, relatively elite, disconnected community? If it's going to the latter, then you've chosen someone in that fight, and you're seen as part of the problem. You know, you being the U.S., us, seen as part of the problem. So that debate is very much going on. The concern that I have with choosing people in that debate is I think oftentimes the entire gamut of religious political movements, which are very diverse in the Muslim world, are all branded as Islamists to be feared. And I don't think that's accurate. I think we need to disaggregate. Can I just to her, just I'll be brief. We should, wherever she went, we should switch places because, frankly, I'd like to hear more from you. I mean, what you said, I think, is exactly right. And even within the Muslim community here in the States, the division between sort of the immigrant Muslim communities and the African-American Muslim community is quite, it's kind of sad. It's very sad, let alone Muslims and non-Muslim minority groups in the States. And I think what you said is probably one of the best answers to the gentleman who asked about political organizing here, or the lady who asked whoever it was about political organizing in the States. I think building those kinds of allegiances with other groups where you have common cause, where you're equally concerned about social justice, where you're equally concerned about discrimination against minorities, where you're concerned about these kinds of issues and you have a lot in common right to start out from, would be an excellent way to start. And I think you're right on. And I'd love to hear your ideas, because it sounds like you're quite involved in it, on how to do that. But you're there and I'm here, so we can talk later.
And then the third question was on education and, I guess, efforts to kind of remove parts of education in certain countries. Would anyone like to speak on that?
Specifically on the issue of the education of Palestinians in Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, Human Rights Watch did a major report on the discrimination and discriminatory treatment in education funding and education services and in schools and infrastructure of Palestinian Arabs and Bedouin Arabs in Israel versus Jewish Israelis. And in fact, you know, the findings of this now 3-4-year-old report stand. There is a huge disparity in the funding the Palestinian citizens of Israel receive in terms of their education versus the education that Jewish Israelis receive. And it's a big problem, and it's reflected in no small part by the, you know, very different poverty levels among Arab citizens of Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, and Jewish citizens of Israel. So it's a problem.
Could I speak to that also? I'm speaking just about textbooks generally, and I just wanted to emphasize the importance that we place on, for example, our NGO partners in issues like textbook reform. And I'm just thinking of the Freedom House study with they did a study on Saudi textbooks, and they briefed us, and it just really struck me that there are really things that the long arm of government can't get into because how can we really assess the textbook curriculum of every country in the world? It would be very difficult. So, I mean, the partnerships that we have with NGOs on the ground are just so important to us. And, you know, when information is brought to light in things like textbooks and very, like, micro-level things, it's something that we really value. And so I just wanted to mention that.
Yes. Can I just make a quick comment about the textbooks? I've seen this happen even in Asian countries with Japan and China and Korea. So I would encourage every one of you, because it's not the role of the government or just the role of the government. It's not just the role of the – it's everybody's job. And as savvy and intelligent as you guys are here, unfortunately, many people, especially – and even in America, they're not as vocal. So I would encourage you to reach out to your friends who aren't necessarily in New York, who aren't necessarily in America, and don't assume that they know exactly what you know, because they don't. So it's everyone's job to make sure that it happens.
Assalamu alaikum. For those who do not understand, it's an invitation to peace that is always responded with, the peace be with you, the peace be with you. And I think that unless we are educated, we do not go much further. It's not just about educating the others, it's also educating ourselves. Welcoming what is given to us as a gift, as it happened many years ago when Muslim scholars gave us back the classics that were lost in Europe and were found again through the Muslims. We learn Aristotle and the others because the Muslim kept them alive. I think that it's important for us to realize that when we see the madrasas being transformed into a hate school, it's a very sad moment for everybody, not just for the Muslim world. It's sad for everyone. We are losing something. We are losing something as humanity. And I think that we do need to keep back this discipline of learning that has to do with truth, not just with these mere distinctions that seems to be real to us and are actually not that real, and that we should always overcome in seeking a truth that is actually larger, bigger, better, more hopeful.
Thank you very much for generously giving of your time to all our panelists.